Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with baritone William Stone. The newly appointed Temple University professor will, this weekend, lead students in a Kimmel Center performance of a work for which he's won a Grammy Award. The Philadelphia Museum of Art moves ahead with its largest expansion ever. Susan Lewis has an update on progress. Jason Pfeiffer watches the national production of Wicked load in at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia and examines the challenges of staging a traveling blockbuster theater production. There's been a marked increase in incidents of major art theft in the past years. Albert Stumm examines the growth in art crime. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we visit the Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum in Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
William Stone picked up a Grammy for the 1990 recording of William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast with Robert Shaw and the Atlanta Symphony. On Sunday evening, he steps onto the stage of the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra and Combined Choirs, conducted by Alan Harler and Luis Biava, to perform a piece that's become one of his signatures. William Stone stopped by our studios earlier this week.
I was very fortunate to have been one of Robert Shaw's, I guess, favorite soloists at the time I was doing it. We were doing a number of concerts. We had already recorded the Lilacs, When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom, the Hindemith Requiem, which won a Grammy. And then he asked me to do the solos in Belshazzar's Feast. And he also won a Grammy for that recording as well. So those are the two recordings of his that I am on Grammy-winning recording. So that's where I really got my start with this piece.
You mentioned the fact that this is a very, very difficult piece for chorus. How has it been for you working with the Temple University students on this piece?
Well, I actually see them for the first time tonight. I've been stopping into rehearsals to hear how they're going, and I've been talking with Alan Harler, who's the choral conductor and will be conducting this piece. And it's a very, very difficult piece for them. I heard the first rehearsal they had at the beginning of the semester, which was actually the day before classes started, and they were doing really remarkably well. But it's an extremely difficult piece. It's a demanding piece vocally because it just is. And it's unusual for a university group to do a piece as difficult as this, but it's a thrilling, thrilling piece. I mean, you get goosebumps, and it has some absolutely beautiful music by the waters of Babylon, and some wonderful, wonderful moments in it.
And I guess their participation in this concert made all the more daunting because of the fact that they've got William Stone standing in front of them.
Well, I hope that we will all do our very best. That's what we're trying to do, and it's a pleasure for me. This is the first time I will have actually performed not in a professional venue, but in a university setting, and I'm very pleased to be a part of the Temple University community, the Boyer College of Music and Dance, and I just think that's what we need to be doing, and I've been singing professionally for over 30 years, and it's time for me to give back a little bit what has been given to me along the way. My teacher taught really a way of life. It's not just something that you learn and put in a box or you take singing lessons. That's not what makes a singer. What makes a singer is the whole person, and what makes a singer is having something to say. One of the most influential people in my life was Marguerite Wildenhain, who was a potter in the Bauhaus in the mid-20s in Germany, and she ended up teaching at Guerneville, California, in pottery. She left during the war, but she became a really wonderful teacher and just an artist potter. And I had the good fortune of studying pottery with her one summer. And I was asking her, at the time I was thinking very seriously about just being a potter and not being a singer. And I said, how do I know if I can be successful as a singer? I said, I've worked very hard to learn how to sing, but I really love pottery. I feel like that's something that I really have an affinity to. And I'm just sort of at a crossroads. And she said, well, You have to do it for 10 years. Then you'll know. She said, you don't grow peaches overnight.
Hmm.
And I think that's something that I've always remembered. And it's you really have to make a commitment. You have to commit your whole self to this. And it's not something, it's not an avocation. It's not something that, you know, on the weekends, hey, let's go sing some songs. You know, it's not that at all. It's a really total life work.
Robert Shaw and the Atlanta Symphony featuring our guest, baritone William Stone, in an excerpt from the 1990 Grammy Award-winning recording of William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast. Stone performs this work with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra and Combined Choirs, conducted by Alan Harler and Luis Biava, at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Sunday at 7:30. The concert, which also features the Shostakovich Festival Overture and the Shostakovich Symphony No. 1, is a tribute to Vera Wilson, founder and president of Astral Artistic Services, the Philadelphia-based non-profit agency and advocacy organization for young musicians. For the first time since its opening in 1927, the Philadelphia Museum of Art is expanding beyond its original structure with the opening of a new building across Pennsylvania Avenue. Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis has more on this story.
During the construction of Philadelphia's Palatial Museum of Art on top of Fairmount in the 1920s, another dramatic structure was being built down the hill across Pennsylvania Avenue. Designed by some of the same architects, Zanzinger, Borey, and Mederi, the home for Fidelity Mutual Life Insurance Company was created in an Art Deco style, rich with architectural details, sculpture, color, gilding, and a soaring arched entrance facing the museum. When it opened in 1927, it was dubbed the Gateway to Fairmount Park. However museum-like it looks to us now, the building served as insurance company offices for most of its life, first for Fidelity, then for Reliance Standard Life Insurance Company. Insurance companies viewed themselves as caretakers of the citizenry, and the facade is filled with symbolism of these nurturing roles, with sculptures of a mother and a father, reliefs of the seven ages of man, and golden rooftop sculptures of the Owl of Wisdom, the Dog of Fidelity, the Pelican of Charity, the Opossum of Protection, and the Squirrel of Frugality. In 1999, the Art Museum announced its commitment to acquire the building, and the next year received an unrestricted gift of $15 million from Ruth and Raymond G. Perlman. In October 2004, the museum broke ground for a new addition to expand the building in the back. Gail Harrity, the museum's chief operating officer, says that the significance of this acquisition is tremendous.
The Perlman Building renovation and expansion is a huge milestone for the museum. It's very exciting. It's the first time the museum has stepped out of its footprint for 78 years since the completion of the main building in 1928.
The Department of Costumes and Textiles will have new space, including a 2,000-square-foot gallery for its over 30,000-piece collection, which ranges from Chinese Han Dynasty textiles to Grace Kelly's wedding dress. The Department of Prints, Drawings, and Photographs, with over 100,000 prints and drawings by Thomas Aikens, Auguste Rodin, Marcel Duchamp, Picasso, Cézanne, Winslow Homer, and William Blake, just to name a few, will also have galleries, as well as a conservation lab, a study room, and storage. These collections especially will benefit from this particular space, says Harrity.
To a large extent, these collections that are housed here are collections that require a very close adjacency of space between storage, study center, and exhibition galleries. So, for example, works on paper and works on textile need to be rotated quite frequently. They are subject to damage if exposed too long to light. And therefore, for a lively exhibition program, you want to have galleries that change frequently and with works on paper or photographs or costume and textiles. And those collections made the most sense.
Harrity says that the ample light streaming through the walls of windows in the Perlman Building make it ideal for exhibiting sculpture or working on restoration.
The primary space, particularly where there's great light, will be used for conservation labs. Northern light is central and critically important for those functions.
The collection of modern and contemporary design has over 1,000 objects that tell the story of design through appliances, furniture, ceramics, and glass and lighting. An educational resource center will be available for schools in the 5-county region. The museum's library and archives will expand into a space 4 times the size of the current library in the main building, with rare books and manuscripts and new technology, including 30,000 digital images in a searchable collections database. In addition to its shared family history and proximity, the Perlman's artistry and composition make it a natural fit with its bigger sibling across the avenue. Many of the construction materials are similar, like the granite, clay, and stone tiles on the roofs. The Casota stone of the museum is also in the Perlman's interior stairway. To accomplish this restoration and addition, the museum turned to Richard Gluckman of Gluckman Maynard Architects, whose work includes Santa Fe's Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in New Mexico, the Mori Art Center in Tokyo, the Museo Picasso in Malaga, Spain, expansion of New York's Whitney Museum of American Art, and the conversion of the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh. Gluckman says that there are reciprocal design details in the Philadelphia Museum and the Perlman Building, and some evidence that they were meant to speak to one another in an architectural sense.
I think one of the more significant architectural details is the way the vaulted entrance of the Perlman Building relates to the vaulted grade entrance into the main building, which had been an entrance to the building in the last 20 years or so, had been used as a freight entrance, but will be converted back to a public entrance and will help create a much stronger visual and physical link between the two structures.
While the Perlman entrance faces the museum, it backs up to smaller-scale residential housing. On this neighborhood side, the furthest away from the main art museum building, a new addition is going up. This section is separated from the original insurance building by a 35-foot-high glass ceiling atrium called the Galleria. And so with a capacity for multiple uses, as well as public spaces with a cafe, a store, and areas for events, Gluckman says that the new building is more than an annex.
This building is intended to be sort of a dynamic, almost freestanding component, similar to the campus of buildings that the museum operates on the parkway. I think the biggest challenge was integrating a very complex and dense program into a project that incorporated restoration and addition and intervention. Its complexity, I hope, leads to its richness.
The Perlman Building is phase one of the museum's master plan, which includes additional galleries in the main building for American art, Asian art, and contemporary art. It will open in mid-2007.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. When Wicked opened at New York's Gershwin Theater in 2003, it was an immediate hit. The Stephen Schwartz musical picked up 3 Tonys and a Grammy, and one reviewer suggested it was good enough to run for a decade or two. Now, over 2 years later, Wicked is still going strong, with continuing runs in both New York and Chicago and an upcoming opening in London. The musical is also on tour, where its latest stop is Philadelphia's Academy of Music. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer was at the Academy this week as the crew of Wicked began setting up the show. He has this report about their life on the road.
Tuesday was load-in day for Wicked at the Academy. If one happened to pass by the theater, it was obvious a demanding task was at hand. Half of Locust Street was partitioned off by orange cones as 20 or 30 men lined up to unload the 18-wheeler trucks parked at the stage entrance. We're not talking about unloading a couple of trunks with a few costumes, props, and set design backdrops. This touring production utilizes 14 53-foot semis to transport all of their equipment and design elements. Racks and racks of lights, computers, set pieces, and sound equipment are being carted onto the stage to be unpacked, assembled, and installed in less than 36 hours. It isn't a marathon. It's a sprint. Wicked is the prequel to The Wizard of Oz tale. Based on the 1995 book by Gregory Maguire, the musical provides the backstory of the relationship between the Wicked Witch of the West, a social misfit born with emerald green skin, and Glinda the Good Witch, a naturally beautiful and popular girl in the Land of Oz. This musical has captivated thousands of people, including Brendan Quigley, the head electrician of the Wicked Tour. He's been with the show since its pre-Broadway days in San Francisco, and by his count, has watched about 1,000 performances of the blockbuster. He says he still enjoys the show. One of Quigley's main jobs is to oversee the lighting of Wicked. There's a bustle of activity on all sides as he stands center stage. He notes that the lighting scheme of the touring show is comparable to the Broadway setup, except that the tour uses more automated lights. The production includes a smoke-breathing dragon, flying monkeys, and of course, a witch in a black hat flying with her broomstick. Although some of the resources of the tour version of Wicked are different than those of the productions that stay put in one city, Brendan Quigley explains that the traveling show is no less ambitious. They want to provide
the same experience here in Philadelphia that you're going to have in New York or Chicago or anywhere you see Wicked.
The Wicked Tour just passed its one-year mark, It kicked off in Toronto last March and has been on the move since. With such a variety of venues, there's a constant need for flexibility. David Hansen, the production stage manager of Wicked, says the Academy of Music, for instance, has some tricky sight lines.
The seating here comes all the way around to the side, so, you know, keeping masking on the side so people aren't watching into the wings, being able to see the whole show with these side boxes and side seats, we want to make sure that everyone still has a good view.
Hansen says the mixing of live sound also becomes complicated at the Academy. Because of the layout of the hall, Wicked's sound console must be situated at the back of the house, off-center, under an overhang. This makes finding the correct sound balance of the auditorium more difficult for the audio technicians, who are only given one brief sound check before a show opens in a city. Sound technician Douglas Graves.
There's a different philosophy for each place. Rock and roll shows, you can kind of just turn everything up and try to, you know, outdo the acoustics of a hall, but especially in a theatrical show, really you're at the whim of the acoustics of a hall and try to work with it.
Beyond adjusting to the different venues of each city, living on the road requires flexibility. Production stage manager David Hansen has mainly been doing theater tours since 1981. While he jokes he's come to associate the word pack with other four-letter words, he's not ready to give up living out of a suitcase.
There's more of a challenge with moving a show every 3 weeks, 2 weeks, or every week, depending on what the job is. Getting it set up, getting it right, it does wear and tear more on you. It's, you know, better to have your own home, your own bed to go back to every night. But it's certain people are built to tour and certain ones aren't, I think, and I've always enjoyed it.
As the one in charge of the show on the road, Hansen says he doesn't get the opportunity to fully experience many of the cities he passes through. Instead, he's often in the theater 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. Fortunately, most of the other members of the nearly 80-person traveling company are not in Hansen's boat. Head electrician Brendan Quigley.
I do nature and wildlife photography on the side. You'll find a lot of guys play golf. There are a lot of people that are able to carry on hobbies out here. It's okay being on the road.
It's a good thing that the company is okay about being on the road because their presence is in high demand. Last fall, mere anticipation of their production broke first-day box office records for any touring stage musical in Philadelphia. This is the first time the tour of Wicked has come through the city of brotherly love. The tour's next stop is Boston, and before long they'll begin return engagements to other cities. Although nothing official has been announced yet, local promoters are hopeful Wicked will be back in Philadelphia again soon.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Wicked is at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia through April 9th. Though often thought to be just the stuff of movies, a dark side of the international art market really does exist. A massive network of thieves, smugglers, dealers, and even buyers, unwitting or otherwise, conspire to move vast amounts of cultural property throughout the world every year. Now Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm takes a look at international art crime and the role of Philadelphia-based law enforcement officers in fighting it.
Most theft actually occurs through fraud and forgery. Altogether, the illegal art trade adds up to a huge problem, falling just behind drugs and arms dealing as the most prevalent international crimes. Philadelphia agent Robert Whitman leads the FBI's year-old art crime team based in Philadelphia. He says art theft is more common than the public realizes. The appeal of stealing valuable artwork does not surprise investigators. Whitman says thieves see museums as easier targets than, say, banks, and authorities know thieves usually have links to a complex network of smugglers, dealers, and buyers who help move stolen pieces throughout the world. But once a thief has made a successful burglary, unloading the stolen goods can be very difficult. And many times, that's how they get caught. Nevertheless, big-ticket museum thefts happen at an alarming rate. To name a few, one version of painter Edvard Munch's The Scream was stolen from the Norwegian National Gallery in 1994, while the country was engrossed in the Winter Olympic Games. It was later recovered, but last year a different version of this iconic painting was taken from the Munch Museum in Oslo. In 1998, thieves swiped two Van Goghs and a Cézanne from the National Gallery of Modern Art in Rome. And in the biggest art theft ever, two men posing as police officers made off with seven paintings from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. None of the Gardner paintings, now estimated to be worth $500 million, has ever been recovered. In the case of cultural and historical artifacts, U.S. Attorney Robert Goldman, the lead prosecutor who works with the FBI's art division, says looting represents an equally taxing problem. Internationally, authorities and cultural institutions have begun working together to dampen the illegal art market. The University of Pennsylvania's museum, for example, has mandated clean provenance, meaning a clear record of ownership history and origin, for all its acquisitions since 1970, and other museums have followed suit in recent years. Also, the U.S. government has mirrored other nations in passing stiffer punishments for art crime. After the theft at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, the United States passed in 1994 the Theft of Major Artwork Act, which made it a federal crime to steal, sell, or knowingly buy any cultural object worth $5,000 and older than 100 years, or worth over $100,000 at any age. Even so, the tougher laws have not had the deterrent effect they intended, and many experts in the field agree that art crime is on the rise. It's a case of simple economics. As more people find an interest in collecting art or pieces of history, fewer of these objects go up for sale on the legal market, driving up the price consumers are willing to pay. The higher price tag inevitably will attract unsavory attention, leaving criminals to supply the demand. And until the demand for stolen art is stanched, no amount of FBI recovery investigations will keep work from disappearing.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to?
Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm. You can find more information on this and all of the other stories you hear on our program by surfing over to our website, www.wrti.org. For this week's dip into the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, we're going to play a word association game. Ready?
Ready.
Okay. I say Philadelphia, you say...
Cheesesteak.
Okay, okay. Maybe you do, but you probably also think history. You know, the Liberty Bell, Independence Mall, and tons of museums. This is one of the beauties of the city, tons of museums, both big and small, old and new. Okay, now another word association game. I say Civil War, you say...
Gettysburg.
Okay, sure, but what about I say Civil War, you say... What were we just talking about?
Philadelphia?
Yep, Philadelphia. The city was one of the major forces in the abolitionist movement and the home to many of the soldiers who fought in the war. In fact, Philadelphia is still home to the oldest Civil War museum in the country, founded in 1888 by a group of former Union officers. John Rum is executive director of the Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum in Philadelphia. Over the past couple of years, the museum has expanded its focus beyond the political stories of the war to personal battles for freedom fought by so many during this time. Rum says you can't tell the story of Philadelphia in the Civil War without telling the story of the Underground Railroad. However, the story of the Underground Railroad is not easily told through a museum collection, as Education and Community Outreach Coordinator Millicent Sparks explains.
There's not a lot of materials that are available in terms of enslaved Africans weren't running carriages.
But even pointing out a fact like this to visitors encourages them to think about the truths of slavery and the risks faced by those seeking freedom. Millicent Sparks also does extensive programming with living history actors. She herself greets school groups as Harriet Tubman and even takes the show on the road to prisons and rehabilitation centers. In the role of one of history's most important heroines, Sparks Tubman reminds people of the struggles of the past, hoping that they won't take the present for granted.
Yeah.
Telling the story of the Civil War is done mostly through artifacts, sometimes unlikely ones. The four-story Center City townhouse has the dusty feel of an eccentric collector's home. When entering, visitors are greeted by the museum's somewhat unusual mascot. Assistant curator Andrew Cauldron gestures to the front of the room. George Meade was a revered general in the Civil War and later the commissioner of Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. Old Baldy was Meade's favorite horse and even marched in the general's funeral procession. The great war horse lived 10 years longer than the great general. But when the Civil War veterans who started this museum's collection heard the horse had passed, they wanted to save his memory, and they went through great lengths to do so. Many of the collections were acquired and donated by this group of Philadelphia-based veterans. The rest was given by families later. Because of this, the collection is mostly Union, but there is a small room dedicated to the Confederate Army. Mostly things picked up in the field, or in the case of former Confederate President Jefferson Davis, acquired after he was captured. On display is Davis's purple paisley smoking jacket and one of his cigars in a plastic tube marked for evidence. There's a whole room dedicated to Abraham Lincoln, with paintings and busts, even a lock of his hair, contained in, what else, a locket. Of course, the museum also has some typical war museum stuff, guns, swords, and uniforms, but it also has more personal belongings, which tell more personal stories. A handmade calfskin bag, watercolours of landscapes, and love letters home. Executive Director John Rum says it's these personal touches that make this museum different. The Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum of Philadelphia plans to move forward with its mission of telling the individual stories of the war and the struggle for freedom in a new, as yet undisclosed location. Rum will say that they will remain in Philadelphia. In the meantime, General Meade's horse, Old Baldy, will continue to guard the collection at 1805 Pine Street in Center City, Philadelphia. More information on the Civil War and Underground Railroad Museum of Philadelphia is at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Carol Morganti, Irene Petratos, Frank Lucy, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.